Welcome to NBC Sports Pro Basketball Talk Podcast. Brett Polakoff here with Kurt Heelan. What is going on, Kurt?
Hey, how's it going, everybody? And hey, Brett.
Good, good. And we also have Dan Feldman with us this week. What's going on, Dan?
Hey, how you doing?
Sound thrilled to join us. I'm just as thrilled as we are to be here. All right, well, let's get started with some of last night's action. We had the Oklahoma City Thunder hosting the Cleveland Cavaliers. We were supposed to get a glimpse of LeBron James versus Kevin Durant. Unfortunately, LeBron was unable to go with a little bit of knee soreness. Hopefully that's not something that lingers, you know, throughout the season for him. But so, you know, not surprisingly, without LeBron, Cavaliers struggled a little bit. Thunder cruise to their fourth straight victory. And guys, Kurt, we'll start with you. Do we think, you know, Kevin Durant back, Russell Westbrook back, that it's pretty much a guarantee now that this Thunder team will end up as part of the playoff picture in the West?
I kind of always thought they would anyway. I mean, honestly, I thought that they'd be able to climb. I mean, with all due respect to Phoenix, I just thought that they were going to get passed in this, and it's going to be tough for somebody like Sacramento or New Orleans to climb over it. Although Sacramento's played a tough schedule up till now, they've got some easier runs coming. They may be the 9 seed at the end of this, but I just don't see how you get past them. And then those top seven are all – I don't even know if the Thunder can catch anybody in the top seven. I mean, they're all playing at almost 60-win pace right now. It's just crazy out west. You saw it in the second game. I mean, like, Houston keeps winning without Dwight Howard on the backs of improved defense and James Harden. But I think they're in. I think Oklahoma City's in, and what gets interesting at the end of the year is how much teams are willing to jockey to avoid them.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the standings in the West. I mean, Dallas is seventh right now, and they're 17-7. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. The fact that the Suns have stumbled to start the season, and they're only 12-11, I think that's helped the Thunder a lot. Dan, what are you seeing so far out of this Thunder team now that they're, you know, pretty much back to full strength?
I mean, they're playing like a playoff team. They're playing like a team that even in this West would probably earn home court advantage in the first round at least if they had Durant and Westbrook for the full season. I'm not as convinced as Kurt that they're going to end up in the playoffs. They're, I think, 3.5 out right now, and that doesn't sound like much, but that's still a lot. They still have to jump a few teams. Even if they play this well the rest of the year, if Phoenix gets hot, it's going to make it all the much tougher to get there. If New Orleans learns how to play around Anthony Davis, or especially can hold their own when Davis sits, then they're going to be tough to pass. It's not as easy as I think Kurt believes to come back from this big of a deficit.
Yeah, I mean, really the key is that they can't afford any missteps the rest of the season with the way the rest of the conference is playing, right? I mean, they can't go on a little losing streak. I mean, what I do like, what I've seen the last, you know, few games, you know, again, they've won 4 straight. I like the aggressiveness of Russell Westbrook early in games, and then, you know, they're pretty much going to Kevin Durant to close things out. I mean, that's a pretty tough combination, you know, for other teams to deal with. And, you know, they're also got some depth. You know, Reggie Jackson's much improved. You know, I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, they really have to win, you know, at the clip that they've won the last few seasons, which is, you know, 70%+ of their games. You know, they're certainly capable of doing so, but it's not going to be perhaps as easy as we might expect.
I agree. By the way, I think Westbrook, I mean, he's been aggressive at the start of all his games, but he had a certain, I want to show Kyrie up, like, who thinks Kyrie's better than me again? Firing his game early last night. He was on it early. But look, I don't think it's going to be easy. I just think that, like you said, and there's no margin for error, but I just don't see how they don't get past Phoenix. And ultimately, like I said, I think Sacramento's probably the 9 seed at the end of the season. Once they get Cousins back, they've been great, and they've played the tough schedule so far. But I still think Oklahoma City gets in. I still think that they're going to get up to 50 wins, and that'll be enough.
Well, you know, since we're here talking about Oklahoma City and the Cavaliers, you know, Cleveland had won 8 straight, you know, before last night without LeBron. Does that mean things are all well in Cleveland? Are we starting to see sort of what we expected, at least on the offensive end of the floor, out of the Cavaliers? You know, pretty much what we expected before the season started. Dan, what are you seeing out of this Cavaliers team, you know, those last 8 games?
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as saying all is well. There are still too many signs of the defensive worries, and the offense isn't at that elite level that a lot of us thought they could get to. But huge improvements from early in the year. If they keep progressing like this, they're definitely on the right track. And unlike Oklahoma City, they have the luxury of being in the Eastern Conference, where they can ride out these growing pains. And and still probably end up with a pretty good seed in the playoffs.
Kurt, what are you seeing out of the Cavaliers? Do you think they're back to what we expected? And yes or no, whether they are or they aren't, is this a team that might look to make a trade midseason before the deadline to kind of bolster that roster, you know, for the home stretch?
I think they're looking around, and we've already heard their name. You know, look, they're likely to get Ray Allen, and we've already heard them essentially go down the list looking for shot blocking big men. They have called everybody who's got one. I don't know that they'll take on Brook Lopez, who's out there, and he's not, you know, the greatest. He's better defensively than he gets credit for, but not exactly a shot blocking big. I'm with Dan on this. They're going to obviously make the playoffs, and it's really hard to judge how good they're going to be in April right now because they're on such a learning curve. But it all, to me, comes back to their defense, and I think the questions are all still there. The thing is, again, they're in the East. They'll get a top 2-3 seed. They'll have home court in the first round. It's essentially like another round to just work the kinks out before things get serious because I think there are four really good teams in the East and some other teams.
Well, you mentioned, you know, Brook Lopez. You know, it's a good way to transition into some of the trade talk, the trade rumors that we've seen surface this week. You know, we can go ahead and start in Brooklyn with the Nets, where, you know, pretty much the entire team is available now, you know, via trade. They got off to a slow start to the season. Pieces aren't necessarily fitting under Lionel Hollins. And, you know, as of right now, you know, Darren Williams can be had, Brook Lopez can be had, and Joe Johnson can be had via trade. The question is, and we'll start with you, Dan, are those contracts too prohibitive to where a team would look to trade for one of those guys?
I don't think they're too prohibitive where a deal couldn't happen, but they're big setbacks. It's tough to make a trade work when the contract is so big and the player is so underwhelming, because unless a team has a lot of cap room, you have to match salaries or come close to it, and it's tough to put together a package to get up to the salaries that high unless you start to include your own really good players. And then if you're including your own really good players, your own high-paid players, then you probably don't want to trade them for guys like Darren Williams and Brook Lopez and Joe Johnson, guys who are pretty good, but not quite on the level of their salary.
Well, Darren Williams right now, 2 years remaining on his deal for $21 million and $22 million respectively. The next 2 years, it's a player option that second season, which, you know, given his injury history and, you know, sort of the stage he's at in his career, it'd be tough to see him not taking that player option for $22+ million. Brook Lopez is in a similar situation. He's got a player option for more than $16 million next season with his injury history. Tough to see him being willing to turn that down. And then Joe Johnson has 1 year beyond this one for almost $25 million. Kurt, which of those guys, if any, do you see being most likely to be traded?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word likely. I think if I were going to gamble on one getting moved, it'd be Brook Lopez. $16 million is like you said, he'll pick up the player option, and there's obviously the injury history and risk there, but big men are a premium, and I think somebody will gamble on a big man. With the point guard, there's so many good point guards in this league that so many teams aren't looking for a point guard that Darren Williams, while some team might be willing to gamble on him, but that's more money, it's a huge injury risk, and there's just a smaller market. Every team could use a big who can score. And look, healthy Brook Lopez puts up points. I mean, that's a very good offensive center when he's healthy. I think you're more likely to find a team willing to take a gamble on him than they are someone else. But I'm still not sure that that gets done in season because it's, like Dan was saying, it's like you've got to figure out a team that's willing to take on that salary and give something back and find a way to improve. And in the last couple trade deadlines have been pretty dead, and this one probably will be too. The current crop of GMs and the way everything is working, they prefer to work in the summer when they've got a little more time than they do at the deadline.
You know, an interesting team for me when we're talking about these Nets, you know, veteran players is the Lakers. And it's because they have the contracts to trade. You know, you could do Jeremy Lin, you could do Steve Nash's expiring deal, and you can get close. You can get, you know, you could probably throw some other pieces in to get one of these guys. The Lakers are looking towards the future. They're trying to maintain flexibility, keep that cap space open once again in the hopes that some star free agent one day will choose to come, you know, play in Los Angeles, whether it's next season with Kobe or the season, you know, beyond that once he's gone. At some point, and we'll start with you, Dan, do the Lakers have to trade for a superstar, even if it's one past his prime like a Darren Williams or a Brook Lopez? At some point, do they have to trade for somebody if no one's going to choose to willingly come to Los Angeles?
I really think they're better off just trying to go boom or bust and say, you know, we're just going to ride out Lins and Nash's expiring contract and try in free agency. Because if you trade for them now, you're locking yourself into what the Nets are. And that's not a very good team, and that doesn't cut it in the East. It's definitely not going to cut it in the West. Even if they strike out next summer, I think that's the better plan, is to try for it. And if you have to endure another year of losing, so be it. I think that's better than getting stuck with those high-priced, mediocre stars.
Yeah, let me jump in. I've heard from people, and I think that this is the buzz around the people who are at the Lakers, and I've been to a few games this season now, and talk to people. They won't say this, but I get the impression they don't want to go get better this season. You know, remember, if they finish in the top, after the lottery, if they have a top five pick, they keep it. If their pick is six or higher, it goes to Phoenix. They would like, as much as Deron Williams or Brook Lopez are nice, that top five pick is a better asset in a trade or just as a player they can get for the future than anything they're going to get. I don't think you're going to see the Lakers make any moves of significance. They have roster spot. I mean, they got roster exceptions for Nash and for Julius Randle when they went down. They haven't filled them. They're not trying to get better. Management isn't going to come out and say it, but I think they're quietly tanking, hoping, you know, let Kobe rant and we'll be bad, and then, you know, we'll make our swings this summer and we'll have the draft pick as part of that.
Yeah, I think that's, I think that's accurate. I think those are all good points. You know, not using the roster exceptions is a little weird to me, because, you know, why not just add a young player, if nothing else, for practice, you know, get a look at a guy, see if he might be, you know, a piece for the future. So even if they don't want to get better now, you know, there's plenty of fringe NBA guys that are, you know, close to making the league. You know, why not bring somebody in and take a look at them? That part didn't make sense, but I think both you guys are right. Lakers probably are better off, you know, waiting it out, you know, at least one more season, seeing what they can do in free agency, and, you know, not saddling themselves with, you know, additional bad situational contracts.
And, you know, by the way, when we talk about the Lakers in that first round pick, in the second round, if their pick isn't in the top 10 picks of the second round, it goes to Orlando. Like, if they got good, they'd actually just wipe their draft picks out.
Yeah, so that's not a good plan.
and with the injury exceptions, that's going to give them extra cap space. So I think that's one reason they haven't brought in players, because their roster's already at a full 15. Now, what they're doing with Ronnie Price and wasting time with him when they should be bringing in some young guys, that I can't explain.
Will Cherry deserves a chance, man. Somebody's got to give Will Cherry some fun.
Yeah, we could start naming fringe D-League guys all day long. All right, well, let's look at another team that had some trade rumors come up this week, and that's the Charlotte Hornets. Obviously off to a very underwhelming start. Lance Stephenson was their big free agent acquisition this summer. He's been slow to fit in with the team, not exactly close to a star-level player. You know, their head coach, Steve Clifford, has said as much. It said, you know, Stevenson's not in rhythm. He's not that star-level guy. It's going to take him some time. You know, teams have been making phone calls on Lance Stephenson. So, Dan, what do you think? You think Charlotte gives up this early on their, you know, big free agent acquisition of the summer?
I think the Hornets are in a real catch-22, because if they want to trade Lance Stephenson, that's a huge signal to every other team in the league that something is wrong with Lance Stephenson. And if they want to, they can't. And if they don't want to, well, then it's fine. You're stuck with Lance Stephenson. That's not a great place to be right now either. He hasn't lived up to expectations. I really don't think Charlotte has any other option but to ride this out and hope he repairs his value, whether that's for them or for somebody else.
No, I agree 100%. And I think the main reason, if you're a team like Charlotte, it's hard enough to convince free agents to come sign with you, right? I mean, they threw a ton of money at Al Jefferson. That made sense for him. You know, Lance apparently didn't have any better offers on the open market. You know, the Pacers, in my opinion, you know, sort of intentionally came with a bad offer. I don't think they really wanted him back for the dollars it was going to cost. But you look around, you know, Charlotte's one of those markets, man. It's going to be tough to convince free agents to come there. And if you bail on Lance Stephenson midway through the first season where you signed him and got him to come, I think, you know, not only does it signal to the rest of the league that there may be something wrong with Lance, but I think it signals that the organization, those commitments that they may make to you are essentially worthless.
That's actually a great point. I mean, they've got to find a way to ride this out. And like you said before, I think the bigger issue is that the league has figured out that chemistry issues are following Lance. Whatever went wrong in Indiana last year, and I don't think that was all Lance, clearly had some stuff that followed him. He can't pair with Kemba Walker. Kemba's a pretty easygoing guy. I mean, they're just – this was a team that had very good chemistry and a great locker room in Charlotte last year and now doesn't, and there's one obvious thing. And I think that's going to scare a lot of teams off from offering anything of value.
I will say this about Lance. You know, he showed some pretty good restraint this week after Rajon Rondo basically just elbowed him in the face in that game the other night. Dude, has that play just gone totally under the radar? Like, shouldn't Rondo just be, like, completely suspended for that?
It's Lance's reputation as a flopper is the only reason it hasn't, because if you look at it from the right angle, maybe you can convince yourself that Lance flopped a little bit on the play. Doesn't make it any less dirty, doesn't change Rondo's intent, but it maybe changes the public opinion of it just a little bit.
And not only the public, the league office has long kind of while saying they don't, you know, look, they take history into account.
Well, you know, obviously looking at the flopping warnings this season, the league's gone about it a bit differently, right? I mean, we used to get, you know, official press releases every time there was a flopping warning. And now, you know, this season, more than anything, they're not doing anything. They're not saying anything about it. You have to go to that NBA.com/official page and they'll post it when it happens and a link to the video. But it's really with a lot less fanfare. And it's also really hit or miss. I mean, some of them are just, you know, silly. You know, two of them this season were guys like falling down after shooting threes with maybe some contact, maybe not. I mean, a couple of them have been egregious. The one I posted about Amir Johnson, like he fell as though like a landmine went off near him. But I don't know. I think the league has kind of realized there's really not much they can do where the flopping stuff is concerned.
Yeah, they haven't made the commitment they need to. I mean, you could really put a fine in. You could really make this hard. You could really do all this stuff and make it. It's more than embarrassment. Like, they try to embarrass guys into doing this, and that's not going to be good enough. You've got to make them pay out of them. If the fines were big enough, you could do it. But the league doesn't want to go there. The owners didn't want to go there. They chose not to tweak this system. And the system now is, you know, hey, I mean, what did we say the other – who got fined the other day? And was it Hibbert? And then Hibbert got a warning. And I posted it. I'm like, you know, if Hibbert gets a second fine – second warning and gets the $5,000 fine, that works out to 0.0003% of his salary.
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to stop him.
Yeah, it's almost like they would have to do something where, like, if an official falls for it during a game, like, and calls a foul as a result of, like, one of these blatant flops that the league is, you know, warning guys for, you know, make it a $25,000, $35,000 fine. You know, something a little bit more substantial, but I don't know, man. They've just been, but you know, the policy's been toothless from the beginning, and you know, I don't see it changing anytime soon.
Yeah, I think they thought they could embarrass guys into doing it, and most of the guys, especially you know, the Lances and the guys who are making a lot of enough money, it's like it's not going to stop them. They're just going to keep doing what they're doing because they're not getting called on. It's got to be egregious before they even get to it.
All right, well,
I think the real underlying problem is just that it's too hard from the outside to tell what's a flop. Like you mentioned, some of the warnings this year have been for guys just falling down, and it's tough to find someone, especially a large amount, when you're just not sure whether they flopped. I don't like flopping, but it's not an easy thing to diagnose from afar.
All right, well, we had one more sort of trade rumor. This one I wouldn't even put in that category. It's almost a pseudo-trade rumor, but it surfaced today with, you know, report saying that Carmelo Anthony might be willing to waive his no-trade clause with the Knicks in such a disastrous situation right now. You know, reports of dissent on the team with, you know, him and Tim Hardaway Jr. in the locker room. Reports of guys, you know, saying Carmelo Anthony shoots too much. It's bad for the offense. They, you know, they hate the triangle offense. You know, they have a terrible record on the season. Dan, what do you make of that report that came out? You know, it was basically shot down immediately by Melo's agent and then by Melo himself at shoot-around.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how true it is. I find it interesting that somebody wanted that out there, that somebody wants people to believe that Melo would do that if the Knicks came to him and said, you know, we have a trade and we'd like you to waive your no-trade clause. He'd be open to it. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't. Like you said, he shot it down pretty quick. But just the fact that somebody wants that out there, to me, suggests that there's a deeper problem in New York, which is obviously the case, you know, from everything else we've heard. I think this just adds to what's going on there.
Yeah, I think it's curious, like, and we don't know, but I'd be love to know, did that come from somebody in the Melo camp who is essentially saying, hey, if they want to do this, we'll at least listen? Or did that come from somebody in the Knicks camp trying to plant that seed? I mean, you knew the round of denials would come, but and we're back to very difficult contract to move. I mean, insanely difficult contract to move. And what team is both going to take that on? And if you're going to bring him in, you've got to bring him into a system where he's – I'm not sure he's an alpha dog. I'm not sure he's the number one guy on a really contending team. What team is going to have that both cap space and then the system around him to put him in? I'm not sure you can move him easily. And even if you could, I just – would he waive it? You know, part of the reason he chose where he is he chose New York over Chicago as a city, as a life, and I don't know that he's given that up.
I mean, to me, that's it. That's the entire thing exactly. I mean, you're talking about a guy who forced his way from Denver, and Carmelo's never ran away from that. I mean, even this season, last season, he's brought that up himself, you know, when talking about this stuff. He's been saying, like, look, I basically did a lot of work. I forced my way to come to the New York Knicks. This is what I'm about. I want to be here. I re-signed here. We all know he re-signed there for the ton of extra money. You know, he could have gone to Chicago for maybe close or not close. Like
now, way less.
Yeah, way less. Like $30 million less, one season less. But he would have been in a winning situation. I honestly think that as fans, as media, we tend to overestimate the importance of winning to a lot of these guys. I mean, if you can get a max contract, if you can be, you know, a rich, you know, famous professional athlete living life in New York City, you know, the losing is tough to deal with, sure, during the regular season, but, you know, do you want to win by going to live in Oklahoma City if you're Carmelo Anthony? You know, I don't think so. I just don't think that stuff weighs on these guys as much as we'd like to think it does.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. There's a lot more to it, although I think being in New York is part of it. I think money was the number one thing, as it would be for most people if they're considering a job. Not only because the money is important, it's nice to have money, but it also signals how committed an organization is to you. So that's again why I find this so interesting, is that the Knicks very clearly said, you know, we'll pay you whatever it takes. They gave him this huge, huge contract, and now it's already going south. Right? And like Kurt asked, are the Knicks wavering? Is Melo wavering? Where is this coming from? Is it coming from both sides, just one right now? Is one side trying to convince the other? You know, I don't think Melo's anywhere near waiving his no-trade clause, but the fact that this report came out today, I think shows that something is happening where it's on the direction where it could go that way if things continue to go so poorly in New York.
He could still play with Kobe and the Lakers. That's all of their problems, man. I want Kobe and Carmelo and Nick Young on one team and with one ball and see how that goes.
Yeah,
there would get Lance Stevenson there too.
Yeah, that would be something to watch. You know, real quick on the Knicks. You know, while we're here, you know, obviously that we knew they were going to lose this season. We knew they probably weren't going to make the playoffs with this team, especially with the new head coach and Derek Fisher, who's inexperienced. You know, trying to basically force feed that triangle offense, you know, to guys where clearly they don't fit that system. You know, if this is just speculation, but if Derek Fisher was going to be fully autonomous as a head coach, you guys think he would choose to run the triangle offense, especially this season with this group of players?
Yeah, I do. But this is sort of maybe this is sort of cheating your question. Even if Phil Jackson said, I'm going to have no input on how you coach, you know, do whatever you think is best, he wants to keep his job, and that means keeping Phil happy. He knows why he got this job. It's because of Phil. He knows how to keep this job because of Phil. So I really think, you know, he's going to do what Phil wants. Even if Phil isn't pressuring him to do it, he's going to do what he thinks Phil wants.
Yeah, and the other part of that is what the needed more than anything was a new roster and a talent infusion. But second, there has to be a culture change within that locker room and within that organization. And that's going to come at a price of some losses and some ugliness and some infighting and people who don't want to give up their shots or their power in the organization or all this other stuff. So there was bound to be, especially in New York with that media, there was bound to be some rough spots. And I don't think at this point you just can't change course to win a few more games and be less bad. By the way, this is a year you have your pick. like next year, if you want to change course to be less bad because you don't have your pick, you traded it away, that's fine. You've got your pick this year. You've got your first round pick. If you're going to be bad, this is the year to do it.
Yeah, it's all, you know, all excellent points. Well, you know, we talked about how hilarious it would be to see Carmelo Anthony end up on the Lakers. Little news out of Lakerland yesterday where, you know, Kobe Bryant was caught in front of the media on video basically cussing out Mitch Kupchak on his way out of practice, saying these guys aren't doing anything for me. Seems a bit odd to me. You know, most teams close practice until the very end where guys are just stretching or shooting free throws. You know, to be fair, you know, since training camp, the Lakers have open practice to media where they've been able to see scrimmages, you know, get a glimpse of Kobe Bryant in action. We've seen trash talk between Kobe and the players before that was filmed by the media. So I don't know that this was completely staged, but, you know, I think Kobe definitely knew the media was present and that, you know, his sort of fiery outburst would get picked up. You know, Dan, what did you make of the way Kobe behaved in practice yesterday?
I mean, it's tough to say what Kobe's intent was. I don't think he was directing anything at Mitch Kupchak. I think what his message was to his teammates, but direct, you know, the words to Mitch Kupchak saying, you know, what's the point of me practicing when my teammates aren't even good enough to help me get better, you know? Because he was going back and forth with Nick Young during the practice, too. So I really think this was more Kobe just having some fun with his teammates. This is how Kobe views fun, getting all fired up and angry and saying these things. But I really don't think this is anything major. I think this is really just Kobe's version of fun.
The other part of that is Kobe has to realize this roster, if they practiced really hard and they did everything right in practice, would still suck. Like, yeah. This team isn't going to be good no matter what. They can't defend. They don't have defenders. They can work all they want on defense. And apparently, it was great. Carlos Boozer said that they actually practiced defense more under D'Antoni, but they talk about it more under Scott. He said Thibodeau practiced it every day, I should say, last year. Every day they ran through drills. Every day they did this. And some of the other guys have said, you know, now they just talk about it, and they actually may have practiced it more under D'Antoni. That, all that said, they don't have defenders. Like, their defense is going to be terrible because of the roster. Kobe has to realize that, and like we said earlier, I don't think the Lakers are bringing in any help because they don't want to get better right now. They want their picks. I think he's trying to push them, and this is how he considers pushing them. Like you said, he's having fun. This is how he pushes them. This is what he does. The question for me is, like, in a long time, look, this is always how Kobe's dealt with guys, in the same way Jordan dealt with guys, and frankly, Bird and a whole lot of other guys got in guys' faces. You know, KG, who's the good cop? Because for years it was Derek Fisher, and frankly, the last couple of years it was Steve Nash. Who's the good cop on this roster? Is it Swaggy? I mean, who's the good cop?
Well, the fact that we're calling him Swaggy, I think, is your answer to that question. But, you know, I've been talking about this since Byron Scott's name first came up. I mean, we know why the Lakers hired Byron Scott. It's because they wanted to, you know, sort of instill in the organization, show the fan base that we want to get back to, you know, the storied glory years, right? We want to get back to the past. We want to have those championship expectations, regardless of, you know, how far away the roster may be from actually achieving those results. I mean, that's the reason Scott was hired. But I mean, Scott, for some reason, has a reputation as a defensive-minded head coach. You know, the only evidence I can find is because he talks about it all the time. Because if you look at that last stint he had with the Cleveland Cavaliers, he had some historically bad defenses in terms of defensive efficiency ratings. And then the following year, as soon as he was gone, you know, Mike Brown was able to raise the rating like 10 points with basically the same roster. And now we're seeing the same thing in Los Angeles. The Lakers are terrible on defense. Worst in the league by far in terms of points allowed per 100 possessions. And Scott talks about it a lot, and he's going to make lineup changes, but I just don't know if he's actually capable of coaching up an NBA defense.
Yeah, well, and changing the lineup. Ed Davis should have started in front of Carlos Boozer a long time ago. They were actually looking at it in the preseason, and then injuries kind of sidelined that. But Ed Davis should have started a long time ago, but this really is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic with this roster. It doesn't really matter.
If I were giving the Lakers credit for hiring Scott, I would say the best thing I could say is that every NBA coach, from the moment he gets hired, is on a clock to get fired. At a certain point, his message wears out, players get tired of him, and it just doesn't work anymore. That's true of every single coach outside of San Antonio. So if the Lakers are tanking or knew they'd be bad or some version of that in between, why not hire a guy who people like, especially in Los Angeles, and during these lean years, don't start the clock on a coach you think is good. Get these years out of the way with Scott, and then once the team is actually ready to win, then you can move him aside and bring in an actually good coach.
Well, I think they've actually admitted to that a little bit. I mean, Mitch Kupchak has said on more than one occasion that we have, you know, we're not doing what New York did, which is we're going to be a triangle team and we're going to instill the triangle and we're going to go get players to fit this system. They've said once we get a superstar in, then we're going to figure out what style of play fits that guy, which essentially is saying Byron Scott's a placeholder. Like, as soon as we get, you know, whatever superstar we end up landing, and we're going to build a system around that guy and the people we bring in, then we'll get the coach to fit that system. And it may or may not be Scott. But essentially they're saying he's a placeholder until they figure out who they're going to be.
Yeah, I think it's yeah, go ahead, Dan.
I do think one thing that people think about Scott, and I'm not sure whether this is true or not, but one thing about his reputation is that he's flexible, that he can coach multiple systems. So I'm not totally convinced they don't see Scott as the guy who can become that coach. I don't think he can be, I don't think he will be, but I'm not sure if that's how they do it.
I think the one thing he has going for him is, you know, the fact that he was a former player, you know, that helps in a lot of veterans' eyes, you know, when those messages are coming. And, you know, if and when the Lakers eventually do get another superstar, you know, I don't necessarily like the idea of hiring retreads. I kind of like, you know, what the Celtics did with hiring Brad Stevens. I liked the hire of, you know, David Blatt in Cleveland, even though he's off to a slow start, and it kind of remains to be seen how he'll end up, you know, shaking out. But I kind of like the idea of giving guys with experience on the younger end of their NBA careers a shot. You know, but what Scott does have going for him, you know, is sort of that fact he was a former player, and maybe, you know, he's a little bit more of a player's coach in terms of where those veteran superstars stand. He's already come out, you know, on the side of Kobe Bryant, obviously, more than once this season.
No. Any coach of the Lakers should come out on the side of Kobe Bryant if they enjoy working for the Los Angeles Lakers.
All right, good stuff as always, guys. It's all the time we have left for this week. Make sure and check out all of our NBA coverage at probasketballtalk.nbcsports.com, and we will look forward to chopping it up with you again next time.